Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Hollywood Remixed, a Hollywood Reporter podcast about culture shifts in entertainment. I'm Rebecca Sun.
And I'm Rebecca Ford.
And Rebecca Ford is getting over a very nasty award season-induced virus, so don't adjust your sets. That actually is the real Rebecca Ford. She just lost her voice a few days ago.
Yes, apologies for this.
Each episode, we do a deep dive into a single topic, a type of character or a type of story that has traditionally been underrepresented or misrepresented in pop culture.
So for today's topic, we're going to be talking about diversity in sci-fi, but actually more specifically, race in space.
It goes, race in space.
So we'll take a look back at how space-set film and TV projects have or have not included actors of color, why there's been a lack of representation, and sort of the patterns we've seen when it comes to this. And then we'll sit down and talk with John Boyega about his work in the Star Wars franchise and, of course, his upcoming film, Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker, out December 20th. When we were doing research for this, I found a study from 2014 that looked at the top 100 sci-fi movies and found that only 8% had a protagonist of color, and 6 of them were Will Smith. And TV is also just as bad. Only 5% of lead roles belong to people of color. So back in 2014, you know, things were not great.
Yeah, and that was only half a decade ago.
Yeah.
At the same year, there was an essay in The Atlantic written by Nora Brulatsky, which I thought was really useful as a framing for this discussion. It's titled Star Wars and the Four Ways Science Fiction Handles Race. And so we wanted to run through those four ways really quickly.
You know, I think the first one that was really interesting was when it's used as a metaphor.
Exactly. So sci-fi and fantasy in general has often been used as a vehicle for allegories. One of the topics that fascinates, you know, real life human, modern day humans is race. And so there are a lot of sci-fi stories that are basically metaphors for tolerance and diversity. You've seen that since the original Star Trek series in the 1960s all the way to X-Men, where anytime, you know, the story explores oppressed, an oppressed group of people. Usually it's an oppressed group of aliens. You know, I think that the creators usually think for some reason empathizing towards aliens is a little bit easier or less touchy than asking audiences to empathize towards black people or towards the Jews or other things like that that have been explored in things like X-Men. Now, sometimes it can be taken to kind of a ham-handed extreme, as we saw in the relatively recent Netflix feature Bright, which was kind of taking place in modern day LA. Again, a Will Smith vehicle. But, you know, this was a society in which, you know, humans come, you know, in every race that they come in, but there was a lot of police violence against orcs. Mm-hmm. And it also involves Max Landis writing a line for Will Smith that is, fairy lives don't matter. Yikes. I just wanted to point out Chance the Rapper had a really interesting tweet in response to watching Bright, and I thought it was worth mentioning. He said, I always feel a little cheated when I see allegorical racism in movies, because that racism usually stems from human emotion or tolerance, but not by law or systems the way it is in real life. Mm-hmm. So in other words, a lot of these metaphors sort of, they're kind of about like, oh, it can be all resolved with understanding without actually going into the systemic inequalities that contribute to racism in real life.
Mm-hmm. So the second way that this essay pointed out that sci-fi handles race was as tokens or supporting characters within a story.
Yeah, and that's your standard sort of kind of what Hollywood tends to do with any sort of film and TV, where you have a pretty diverse ensemble, but your lead is still white, One example is when you look at Guardians of the Galaxy, a mm-hmm. franchise that I really love. You know, that franchise stars such people as, you know, such actors of color as Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Palm Clemente. Now, coincidentally, they're all kind of obscured under lots of special effects makeup. Yeah. Yeah. But the lead, you know, the human is still Chris Pratt, you know, sort of your white guy, Chris.
Yeah.
Now, the other type of way in which race is sort of included, or people of color are included as tokens, is sometimes it goes into caricature. And so if you go all the way back into the, you know, the old timey comic book series Flash Gordon, there was that villain Ming the Merciless, who is technically an alien. He's the tyrant of a planet called Mongo. But I mean, Ming the Merciless is just your straight up Fu Manchu mm-hmm. type caricature that, you know, harkens back to our first episode of this podcast when we're talking about the Asian leading man.
Yeah.
Star Wars also actually has been accused of a number of racist caricatures in the way that they have portrayed some of the aliens. You know, Jar Jar Binks, who was, you know, widely loathed in the prequel trilogy. Some people said that the way he talked was basically caricaturizing certain types of African-American vernacular. There's the alien character Ninub, who, if you look at him, I mean, he also looks kind of oriental. Watto, you know, a greedy merchant, sand people. You can, if you're not familiar, you can kind of Google and see a lot of written, what's written about those caricatures there. Now, if people are saying, oh, you're reading too much into it, you know, that's a real stretch. I mean, Star Wars aliens are not exactly subtle. I mean, you have Admiral Akbar and the way he looks, and he's literally a race known as Mon Calamari.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, just saying.
And so another way that we see race approached in sci-fi is in these sort of alternate universes where it's like race doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where you have racial inclusion, but you live in this sort of like post-racial utopia where race is just not a factor in the future or in outer space or whatever. A lot of times this is where racial inclusion is really, really subtle. The essay cited the works of Ursula K. Le Guin, who in her Earthsea fantasy series, she actually, in the descriptions of her protagonists, they were supposed to be people of color. But because it's so subtle, Hollywood had no problem sort of just automatically whitewashing those leads when it came to adapting those projects. Now, this happened in modern day, you know, franchises like The Hunger Games. People who read the book will know that Katniss Everdeen is described as a young woman with, you know, she's a brunette, obviously, but she has olive skin. But, you know, again, she's played by Jennifer Lawrence
yep.
in the Hollywood version.
And the fourth and final way we see race approach in sci-fi is the direct way, where it is actually a part of the story. And Sun, I think Hunger Games actually has something to do with that as well as an example.
Exactly. So in the Hunger Games, you know, the characters are all divided up into districts. And District 11, which is where Rue comes from, is like districts that are predominantly black in real life, subject to more policing, you know, policies that lead to more severe poverty and things like that. Another example is Octavia Butler, the great African-American sci-fi fantasy author. In her novel Dawn, the protagonist is a black woman, and she is just as much questioned about her leadership abilities. You know, sort of there's assumptions made about her choice of romantic partners because she's a black woman. And that basically mirrors the experiences of real life black women. It should be said that Dawn is finally getting a Hollywood adaptation by Ava DuVernay and Victoria Mahoney, the first black director of Star Wars.
That is a great combo. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that essay came out in 2014 along with that study, but I can say I feel like there's been a lot of progress since then, thanks in part to Peak TV and also the revamping of beloved franchises like Star Trek and Star Wars. So I think we should take a closer look at the Star Trek and Star Wars franchises.
Exactly. I mean, these are basically the two pillars of sci-fi in Hollywood. So let's start with Star Trek. You know, the original series all the way back in the 60s already had racial inclusion baked into the OG ensemble. You had Uhura, played by Nichelle Nichols, a black woman as part of the main crew, and you also had Sulu, George Takei, an Asian-American man. And they paved the way for racial inclusion on future Starship crews. You know, you had LeVar Burton as LaForge, as well as a number of supporting characters in every single Star Trek series since the original. And that also meant that when it was time to remake the original crew, the Enterprise crew in the movies, you had, you know, actors of color like Zoe Saldana and John Cho be able to canonically step into those character roles. So there wasn't a complaint about, you know, why did you race bend these characters? They were black and Asian from the beginning. I think it's also worth mentioning that the 90s series Deep Space Nine saw the first black lead of a Star Trek series in Avery Brooks playing Commander Ben Sisko.
Mm-hmm.
Going on with more Star Trek, there is a little bit of a, I don't know if I should, if we should do half credit for Khan, you know, one of the most iconic villains in the franchise. Khan is played by, was originally played by Ricardo Montalban. And then in the Kelvin timeline in the JJ movies, spoiler alert, also played by Benedict Cumberbatch. But then the character is like South Asian. So I don't know. That's a half credit.
Half credit, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Fast forward all the way to today where the current Star Trek series Discovery has a black woman as the protagonist. That's Sonequa Martin-Green's Michael Burnham. The show is incredibly inclusive and also features Michelle Yeoh, the great Michelle Yeoh, as, you know, sort of the first Asian woman we've seen on screen as a Star Trek captain.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at the Star Wars franchise, you know, when it comes to the original films, Lando Calrissian, played by Billy Dee Williams, was sort of the first significant character of color in the franchise. And then later on, Samuel L. Jackson played a Jedi Council member, Mace Windu, in the prequel trilogy. And those are sort of the two major.
Yeah, the two main. One in each trilogy.
Yes, you get one per trilogy. But luckily, the new franchise, I think, is much improved in that front.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, also in the trilogy, you had James Earl Jones heard but not seen as Darth Vader, and obviously Anakin Skywalker is a white character.
Right.
So, you know, that's just James Earl Jones and his amazing deep voice there.
So when it comes to the new franchise, there's a lot of actors of color in, you know, main roles. Of course, Daisy Ridley is the primary lead, but, you know, she's surrounded by Oscar Isaac, Kelly Marie Tran. And now in this latest film, a newcomer, Naomi Ackie, who has a major role in it. And then, of course, more recent standalone films, you have in Rogue One, Diego Luna, Riz Ahmed, Donnie Yen, and Jing Wen. And in Solo, of course, Donald Glover and Tandy Newton. So there's been a lot of great characters brought into the franchise. But there's also been some challenging voices on Twitter and the internet speaking out against both Kelly Marie Tran and John Boyega dealt with that when they were first brought onto the franchise.
Exactly. I mean, it definitely, I think it was compounded for Kelly being a woman of color, and it actually caused her to shut down her social media presence, which definitely was a real shame because I thought she brought such a refreshing candor to the experience of going from somebody who was not publicly known into the limelight, and she was really real online. But yeah, there's still been so much resistance to what people perceive as sort of, oh, why are you shoehorning in all these people of color? Mm-hmm. But as you can see, people of color have existed in both of these franchises going back to the 60s and 70s. And also, it's outer space.
Right.
So I don't know why only white people were allowed to breathe that oxygen, that non-oxygen. But actually, I have another question for you, Ford.
Yes.
Which is, this has sort of also been debated, and I've seen this a little bit in some of the talk around The Rise of Skywalker, which at the time of this taping, some people have now seen, which is, do you feel that these new characters of color are being used in an inclusive way in Star Wars, or sort of as tokens, because you know, when the characters for The Force Awakens were first announced, mm-hmm. you know, it was Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, and Oscar Isaac, yep. sort of as a trio. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that two out of three movies in, it's clear that Daisy Ridley's Rey is the lead.
Yeah.
And Finn and Poe are sort of a little bit more supporting. And, you know, you saw that, too, with Rogue One. I mean, Rogue One was a fantastic ensemble and very, very, very diverse. Mm-hmm. But the lead is still a white female, was Felicity Jones. So, as Jyn Erso. So I don't know, like, you know, how is it using its characters of color sort of equitably?
Yeah, I think, you know, there were a lot of storytelling issues with this new franchise in general, but switching between directors and, you know, that's been discussed at length. So I think the question is how much of these decisions were just storytelling issues in general and how much was really this issue that you're talking about. And I wish we could see more from Kelly Marie Tran's character, or even John Boyega's character. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people wanted to know more about his backstory and things like that. And, you know, I hear that there are potential ideas for spinoffs based on the characters of color in this last one. So, you know, I'm optimistic for the future of this franchise. And I think maybe it's ready for a movie that really stars an actor of color in the lead role, you know?
Yeah. And John talks very, very candidly to us coming up about how he feels that Finn, who, again, is an ex-stormtrooper who defects mm-hmm. to the rebellion, was used both in The Last Jedi and in the movie coming up.
So up next, we'll sit down with John Boyega to talk about everything Star Wars.
So for today's episode, we're so excited to welcome John Boyega. You'll next see him in Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. Thanks for joining us,
John. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start off, obviously you've done a lot of different projects over your career, but there's definitely a through line of sci-fi, you know, from Attack the Block to Pacific Rim and, of course, Star Wars. What is it about this genre that you enjoy being a part of?
I just think I like the imagination element to it all. I like stories that are larger than life. In terms of my movie-going experience, I like going to the movies specifically to watch movies that bring me out of the real world. Mm-hmm. So it's just something that as a kid, I've always wanted to be in the movies that I enjoyed watching. And a lot of that is sci-fi, so mm-hmm. this just felt natural.
Makes sense. And you mentioned, you know, as a kid, and you grew up in South London, and your parents are both Nigerian immigrants. Tell us a little about what the pop culture stories. So this could be anything from movies and TV shows to, like, anime, or anything that you really loved as a kid, and what was it about those specific worlds that you felt drawn to?
I mean, for me, I loved it when more British films were being made, and when the aliens were landing in our country. Mm-hmm. And going past the States, coming over to our place. So I love, like, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead. I liked, you know, Kid Hood. It was much more grounded projects. For me, that's the first time that I really started to notice film, when I saw people from, like, my area, like my city, represented in features. But before then, it's like, we get the same things that they get in the States, so. You know, we grew up on the sisters, the Keenan and Kells, That's So Ravens, all those shows, and, you know, Americanized in that sense. But, you know, to see that through line of British films come through is definitely something that sparked my eye. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Attack the Block must have been your perfect breakout then, because they just come to the neighborhood. And, yeah.
Yeah. So when you were training as an actor, were there types of projects you really dreamed about being a part of, or kinds that you felt you realistically could be a part of?
Everything. I kind of didn't know the world was political until I left training. Mm. That there were certain roles you couldn't do, and all this bull crap, like, the world would now categorize us into, okay, you can only play this part, or what's that one role that you'd be like, I want to play everything, because I was inspired by so many different types of movies.
Yeah.
And I just think your talent and your versatility for an actor, that's your currency, that's your money. You can spend it as long as you got it.
Yeah.
As long as you got it, you can spend it, you know, on different roles. You know, it depends on how much you can transform for it. So for me, I've always been curious about so many different stories. I just think the one genre I cannot crack is horror.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I just don't get it, man. Like, I don't get how do you make, like, to make a good horror movie is, it's not no joke. And comedies too, is hard too, but yeah. I think with horrors for me specifically, like, that's always been the one genre where I've been like, wonder.
Interesting.
Huh. Do you watch horror or?
Not too tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm up for it. And, you know, got a bunch of friends over and I'm like, yeah, you know what, let's watch some horror films. You know, to scare each other then, yeah, but then.
I mean, so you mentioned that, you know, once you actually got out of school and you're you know, actually in the market going for auditions and stuff, yeah. Did you find that there were genre projects or characters that you really could see yourself in or, you know, that you really related to and be like, could actually point to a specific character or an actor and say, like, that's, I'd like to do what he's doing.
As, you know, as I said, I was pretty much inspired by the people that I was seeing coming up from my environment, because to me, like, it was people from the UK, like a Melamine, mm-hmm. like Idris Elba, mm-hmm. Like Noel Clark. People, that's the first for me, like Ashley Waters in Bullet Boy. These were the first, because acting was just so far removed from where we grew up. It just, and it was in America, like, who's going to America? That's so far. Like, no one's going there. Like, who's got the money for that plane ticket? It's just a far place. So the dreams and the specifics, you know, were quite distant, you know. And I wasn't even considering going for it. It was more just kind of like, that's over there and we're here. Until I started seeing these individuals coming from my place. I was like, oh, like, that's what spanned, you know, that's what made the connect for me.
Makes sense.
So tell me about the first time you remember watching Star Wars, the original trilogy.
Or any of the films.
Well, I came onto the prequels first.
Okay.
Because you were born right before the prequels.
Yeah, I was born in 1999, so the Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of marketing around that, and I just remember getting a Darth Maul figure. Mm-hmm. A Darth Maul action figure. I was just like, I didn't know who he was, but I liked what he was holding in his hand. I saw from the previews, he was swinging it, man. He was doing his thing. And as a kid, man, all you're looking at is just imagery, spaceships, and, you know, explosions, and that's all I was in it for. Then watched the prequels, and then got more knowledge on it. Started to get into the video games a little bit more, and then watched the originals.
Do you have any memories about the first time, like, you saw, like, did like Lando Calrissian or Mace Windu, were they distinctive to you in any way, or were they just another part of the Star Wars ensemble?
They weren't distinctive to me at all, to be honest. Like, I just saw all of them as just a part of a big, massive universe, and Samuel Jackson was obviously a star to everyone, you know. With Lando, though, I did think, wow, they had one black guy in there. I wonder how he got the part.
Yeah.
Because at the time, you're like,
yes.
You know, like, I was wondering, like, oh, wow, like, how did they get that one black guy in there, mate? Where, you know, he's talking with the lead characters. He's a cool, you know, he's not used as kind of like the catalyst or the
he's Han's or, best friend.
Yeah, he's Han's, you know, best friend. And he's got wit. I did think that. Mm-hmm. That came to my head. But it's so funny that it's the opposite. It's kind of like, oh, how did he make it in? You know, rather than I'm inspired, I'm like, right. How did you get it? What? How did you win?
And I know you can't say all that much about Rise of Skywalker yet, but do you have scenes with Billy Dee Williams?
Yeah.
Did you guys get to interact? What was that like?
Yeah, we have great scenes with Billy Dee, as we see in the trailer as well. He's around for a lot of that. That was cool. It was great to see what older Lando is like, a more mature Lando, and a Lando that is settled in his views and what team he fights for. That's cool. But just seeing the same swag and the same spark that made everybody fall in love with Lando, you know?
Yeah.
You know, seeing that in Billy, I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
You can be older, you can still rock it. That's something that I've been inspired by. It's real, real cool.
Yeah.
He's pretty quintessentially cool. Did you end up asking him that question about, like, how he ended up in the original trilogy or what it was like for him?
I didn't ever feel like the right moment to start, you know.
How'd you do that?
Yeah. I think what's funny, though, because during Force Awakens, everybody would be like, you know, did you go up to them and ask them questions about this? And did you take the, you know, right. just, they're like, you know, we at work, right?
Like, we can't. You're taking selfies all day. Yeah.
But like, there's some conduct things going on. But maybe I'll ask him that during a press talk.
You'll have a chance, yeah.
So when you were first auditioning for Star Wars, I read that you were considered for both Poe and Finn. Is that true?
No, I never know.
That's not true? Just,
it was always... It was Boy One.
Okay.
No names,
Boy One, right. Maybe that was Poe. And then, but it was always Finn. I always played the guy that was escaping from the place.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, cool. Obviously, this is the stormtrooper, man. You don't. They tried to say, oh, it's about a guy, he's escaping from a really big army.
They
got now.
They wear white armor.
Yeah. They're hard to catch.
But were you aware, sort of, that they were, I assume they were doing colorblind casting for all these roles? Were you sort of aware?
Yeah, I put one of my black friends up for it. My friend up for it. I had a camera. I was actually working on projects with each other. I had a camera and I was reading the lines to him.
Yeah.
And at the time, I hadn't received the call for an audition yet.
Wow.
And I was like, right, I see black people. Star Wars. You know, normally, you know, there's slightly less seasoning with this. Like, they're really trying to... And it's a lead part too. I'm like, ooh, okay, cool. A lot of my friends were going up for it in the actor world. Then black women were going up for it. That's when I'm like, oh, it's getting real. I mean, they ain't never going to have two of us, but...
It's a new world.
That's another obstacle to jump, but
yeah.
It's getting real right now, you know, and that's when I felt like, oh, something's happening.
Yeah, well, I mean, now they have Naomi and, you know,
Rise
of Skywalker.
See how that transition
I'm waiting to see how that works. That's nice. That's nice.
And be in the movie at the same time.
You don't necessarily have
it's
to be siblings.
Like no. We're in the world.
Interesting. There can be more than one. Wow.
Your friend is not upset that you got the role over him, the one you helped audition.
That's his business, man. That's his business, mate. You know what I mean? I did help him with that audition tape. Nah, he's cool.
So when the first teaser for Force Awakens dropped, you know, you're the first face that people saw from a Star Wars movie in like a decade. You know, the helmet comes off and people were right. Stormtroopers are black. Some of them, at least.
Some of them,
There was a lot written about the added diversity in the cast, particularly about, you know, Finn, and some of it was good, some of it was ignorant.
Yeah.
How much were you prepared for that particular reaction over race, over inclusion in Star Wars?
I wasn't really prepared at all, to be honest with you. I didn't think that would be the reaction at all. I didn't think that people would be like, oh, it's a black... I didn't think that people were going to really fixate on it. What I found funny was that racists were... kind of hiding behind the notion that I was chosen just because of my skin color.
Right.
And that I didn't audition for months.
Right.
And that even if you think I'd have zero talent, JJ did and decided that I'd have to go through a process to prove it. So, you know, this is not the imagination, people. This is real life. You know, you can't just get chosen to be in a Star Wars film because you're black. so for me, that level of ignorance, I knew that. I was just like, wow, really? People are dumb? Like,
yeah.
People really are... you know, living in them dinosaur days in terms of the mentality and in forward thinking. Once I realised that, I was kind of like, that's what makes the masses though.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, that's what makes the masses the masses.
Right.
You take away the ability to think, you know, practically and to have perspective, it just makes it, you know, that's just like how they'd like us to be, you know, the general public, which is not really forward thinking and not really aware. Once I was aware of that, I was kind of like, oh, you lot are babies. You know, whoever reacts like that, you're just a baby in the game and just a part of the masses of ignorance. And
I
definitely don't want to be a part of that choir.
Yeah.
So for me, also knowing I had friends that were going up for certain things and that had got certain parts, so I knew, like I knew there was a Black Panther coming.
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew,
you're friends with Letitia.
Yeah,
and
like
you,
I knew these things were coming. So I was kind of like, you know, a lot of projects are coming out that now, you know, are a lot of the opportunity for black actors. I was kind of like, you know, I just kind of warned them, just get used to it, you know.
Right. And at the time you Instagrammed basically that, to whom it may concern, get used to it.
Yeah, man.
And I'm curious if, you know, because this Star Wars and sort of fanboy community is so vocal and active. Has your relationship with social media changed over time? Do you still approach it the same way when interacting with
the people? Yeah, I approach it the same. I approach it the same way. I'm so comfortable with my individuality at this point in my life. I feel like I'm 83 and I don't. I feel like that because I'm like, if any of us were put in my position, like if you were given the part to play Finn, regardless of who I am, even the people on the computers making the bad comments, if that individual, if Star Wars offered them that opportunity to play Finn, those individuals would be judged for whoever they are, whatever they're doing in some way, in a fashion or form. And that's something that I've had to accept over the years. And, you know, with social media, you know, it's just so funny to me how factual people think they truly are. You got dumb out here. Like, what you're talking about makes no sense. Like, I have people online that will give you and will tell you about your life and be like, no. This is what you did. And you're like, no. In actual real life, where, you know, in reality, no, that's not the case. So in terms of that, it changes it. But it's just a mere realization, I guess, for me, living as a normal person, then now living in this whole celebrity world, knowing just like, oh, wow. So we were thinking that, you know, this person was doing this and that person means this and this is what they mean with this. Right. Thinking that we know these people, we don't know a damn thing.
Right.
And we just here wasting our time just debating shit that doesn't really matter. That realization, I was only able to have genuinely living in those two different positions. Because until Star Wars happened to me, you know, I'd be part of that conversation.
Yeah, you're not on the inside of the thing.
I'm not on the inside, you know. I'm not part of the process. I'm like, you know, I'm hearing this about this individual. I'll be like, ooh, is it true? Blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, and then now being on the other side, I'm like, oh, no. Don't get involved in any of that. Social media should be used to express ourselves in a safe way and to have fun.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It gets pretty deep down the rabbit hole in some of those forums. Yeah. On the flip side of sort of fan interactions, what have been some of your most memorable ones or sort of responses that you've heard from people that have meant the most to you?
There was one guy that didn't like the movies. Just hasn't, you know, hasn't been able to get to grips with it. And I saw him, I was just doing a press event in New York and I was coming through the airport. And he kind of like, I was like, I just want to have a conversation with you. I don't really particularly like the movies. But I appreciate you guys, like you, Oscar and Daisy, and what you guys have put into this Star Wars fandom. Like, he told me that his daughter loves the movies. And, you know, he goes, obviously I'm going to debate with her when she grows up. But it's like, it's been nice to even just enjoy Star Wars being around, you know. He did say to himself that he's a bit much more into the novels, but for me, that's the first time I had interaction with a fan face to face in which I was just kind of like, wow, I wish I could have this kind of conversation with everybody on socials. I wish I could.
It's a real
actually
conversation.
It was face to face with somebody. Like, I disagree. Like, I really, as a Star Wars fan, obviously, there might be bias because I'm in it, but, I really liked Force Awakens. I really, really did. I think it was a great way to establish the story. But it's also nice and heartwarming for me to meet a fan who doesn't agree with me, but yet we're still able to have quite a peaceful conversation in which I was kind of like, yeah, man, actually, you're cool and I appreciate you you stopping me.
What's that level of respect, it sounds like?
I love it. I love that.
Yeah, civility. Well, I mean, speaking of like people's responses to the film, we have our very first listener submitted question for the podcast from listener Daniel Sun. He's wondering, what did you think of the direction that Rian Johnson took with The Last Jedi? That's been the ongoing subject of a lot of conversation, and specifically with Finn.
I've been honest in saying that certain parts disappointed me. Like I didn't necessarily dig some of the decisions that were made creatively. I think some of it was selfish on my part too. But in general, all of us, me, Daisy, Oscar, because we just wanted to be with each other.
Right.
You know,
you guys were separated in the,
a little bit more. And for Daisy specifically, I mean, she was like in the trenches working the hard. I say hands down, Daisy works the hardest in this whole franchise in terms of the actors. Like, she's doing a lot of her own stunts, she's training up for stuff, and then she's always, you know, we're in the resistance space with the resistance. Like, you know, we've got more of a vibe on set, whereas Daisy most of the time is by herself somewhere, you know. Figure out her house. You know, that's a lot of on set time by yourself. It's just, you know, cold, and she's always wet all the time. So it's like, you know, that in itself was frustrating. But what I was excited by was I liked the idea of Ryan having his own take on something that was quite important, and I liked the idea of these characters being challenged and separated and stressed, like everyone's just trying to get to each other. That excited me. But, you know, I will be honest in saying I think that they could have done better with Finn, especially with Finn and Rose. And, you know, as a black person, you're gonna feel a bit type of way. You're gonna be like,
absolutely.
You lot knew everything to do with Rey and Kylo when it comes to you lot. The story just wasn't hitting for me anyway, yeah, personally, with Finn and Rose. But, you know, I definitely enjoyed. You know, I didn't notice that on set. It's only when I watched it. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed the experience of making it.
Yeah. And so when it comes to this trilogy and Finn, what are sort of your main priorities about the way he's portrayed? How do you get to weigh in on who he is on screen?
I guess it's complicated in a way because, you know, Mark in himself as well has been kind of honest about that he wasn't feeling. And I can't lie, I was feeling the same way because that's my boy Luke, man. Come on, man. Like, my boy Luke needs to be about it.
Right.
My boy Luke needs to come back and do some damage.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
people want it.
Searching for this guy, we find him on the mountaintop.
Right.
Let's go.
Let's go, Messiah.
I mean, personally, I wanted him to be levitating a boulder, like, or something, man. You know, I wanted him to be levitating a ship, just standing on top of it while it's floating.
Amazing.
I wanted the farm boy to have, you know, his big moment. And like Mark, for some of it, you need to just let that go.
Mm-hmm.
And for some, you realize you were right. Mm-hmm. You were right. It would have been better than it went with your idea, whatever it is. But for some, a lot of it, you didn't still realize as well that actually that's what's best for the story as a whole. And that, you know, is easier to accept. But for what you don't accept, you're always going to be a bit salty and thinking, you know what, man?
Yeah.
They could have whipped that out. You know, I always wanted Finn to be force sensitive. You know, I always thought that.
So. Yeah. Oh, I really wanted it too. I wanted it so bad.
You know, I wanted that, and I did. You know, just to enhance the ensemble feel, I did want Finn and Rey to be side by side in battle. You know, because how many times did that girl go and fight Kylo Ren? Leave her alone.
He's so creepy.
Leave her alone. But you know, I always wanted to see that. But you know what? I just wanted a strong Finn.
Mm-hmm.
But in Force Awakens, I was cool with Finn being weak.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been weak before.
Yeah.
And what frustrated me when people were like, "Oh, we just wanted to be strong and badass." I'm like, all those characters that you find strong and badass had a bloody freaking journey.
Yeah.
You know, Finn should be able to
start
to have that.
Yeah.
And also we have the opportunity of, for me, who Finn is the most human character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
None of you online and none of you at home are running into a battle, you know, saying woohoo and just being
right.
You know, even if you do that, you gotta work up to that point. You know,
yeah.
You gotta have one character that's a bit like, you know, we need to think about it.
So, I don't know about this.
I loved playing that. I just, for me, felt like if we're gonna play him that week, give him an arc, give him a trajectory of strength, because I get Poe's journey, fighting for the resistance. Rey has the force to guide her. Finn so far has just been his mere motivation, you know, leaving the First Order, the story of a stormtrooper that switches up, that changes.
Right.
The one, like the first stormtrooper to kind of add personality to what we've seen. We've seen them kind of like mannequins. So
Yeah, literally.
Like, I feel like he deserved strength, and I think that comes full circle in episode 9.
Oh man, a lot of people will be looking forward to that.
Yeah, man, a lot of people, and even my family, even my mum and dad, even my parents, be like, you know, man, like, when they get let you, like,
right.
Because I'm not no small guy, like, you know, like, I get down with the stunts.
I think you could throw down.
The block, you know, we threw down with some bravery there, and I think seeing that side of things is going to be quite exciting for people.
You mentioned earlier too, like, there's that added awareness that you are one of the few major Black protagonists who have been in, certainly in Star Wars, but also just more largely in sci-fi fantasy. You know, we've talked about this before, Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, you know. And so how much does that sort of add to your desire to have your characters represented in a really specific way?
It's big. Mm-hmm. To the point where, you know, certain times I'd be on set, I'd be like, oh, you know, play a bit more fear. And I'd be like, not doing that this take. It just doesn't make me feel comfortable that every single time the people throwing fear just so happen to have hair that you can't get a comb through. Is it that it's sometimes too unnatural? We're not involved in the buzz of and the feel and the branding of what is the movies.
Right.
So sometimes you're like, yeah, nah, I'm going to put my foot down because, like, you know what? In this particular moment, especially in episode 9, you know, the shot that plays in a trailer with me and Naomi. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, we would pick each other up and stuff. Like, there'll be sometimes I'll be like, no, it's like, I know you're tired and we're cold as hell, but we need to get it. Like, mm-hmm. this is a Black man and a Black woman on horses with a cavalry leading the charge in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And you're not only Black, they haven't light-skinned you and made you, you know,
yes.
a lighter-skinned Black woman. You're a brown-skinned woman with your Afro hair out.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look like, make this look bad. This needs to look really, really cool and really sick. So in those moments, like, you're aware, you know, me and Naomi have very transparent conversations in terms of that, you know. Especially as a Black woman now, joining a franchise, you've got to be worried as to what the trolls are going to say to you.
Right, yeah.
Those are the conversations I would have with Naomi, who has these natural feelings of like, okay, cool, it's new and it's fresh and I'm stepping into a new world. But it's like, you got to have someone there to say, yo, you got this. And I don't know, not to be biased, nothing, but it's just facts. It just feels so good when a Black woman's there on.
Yeah.
Baby, I got you. Like, mm-hmm. I got you, King. Like, let's get this and kill it. And that made me feel real cool.
That's awesome, man. And again, that underscores the importance of why, like, if you just have one,
right.
you it's like you more than like one.
This, right?
Yeah.
The people that are passionate about the fact that their white world is, to them anyway, is dying.
Mm. Yeah.
That's because of the benefits that you've been getting from representation.
Yeah, people will talk to
you. You know what I mean? It's like the same passion. It's the same feel, that same thing that makes you feel like, oh, man, we've been enjoying these characters and they've been, you know, these are the characters we're used to. And that same feeling, what makes you think the next human being doesn't want to feel like that?
Literally.
So for me, and it's getting rid of the lie that we can't all just enjoy, you know, things with different people in, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes I ain't going to go see Henry VIII.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's going to be white in there. I'm not going to be cool with that. It's Henry VIII.
Yeah.
But, you know, in moments when we can expand, bring other people in that are talented, that do deserve the job, but come from these, you know, from different places all over the world, it helps. Especially moved this dying light of cinema, it helps bring it back and move it forward.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah. And you... the other giant sci-fi project you were part of, Pacific Rim Uprising, you were a producer on that as well. And I know you're now, you know, have a focus on producing other projects, even ones you're not a part of.
Yeah.
Why did you want to produce as well and take on that sort of role?
Because I noticed that the culture of people's real lives, like what people experience in their lives, like especially as creatives, is implemented into the decisions that you make for projects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're from a suburban area, all white, and you've never had that curiosity about the world and other cultures, you're probably going to write stories and the leads are going to be from where you're at.
Yeah.
Which is fine, you know, just so as long as we get the buffet of opportunities for then other people.
Mm-hmm.
So with my story, my perspective, I think a lot of the ideas that we're working on, a lot of the ideas and the collaborations that we're even having are unheard of. And... Mm-hmm. In an industry where I've got kind of like double scoop, you know, I know what people are reading right now, you know, I get sent some stuff and to see the kind of ideas that sometimes are being established, they're quite samey.
Mm-hmm.
That's because your experience is samey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your curiosity is samey. You know, you're not reaching out to worlds that you haven't explored. And for me, I never want to get stuck in that. So with producing, I'm able to utilize those skills because, you know, I went over to Jamaica and had a good time and met somebody who told me a strange story that, you know, led me to an article or whatever that I want to get the IP for, you know, or, you know, when I went to Nigeria for Christmas, you know, I went to see my grandma, she tells me a historical story, you know, about the Nigerian riders of the north, and I'm like, you know what, ooh, that would make a good movie.
Yeah.
I find myself just being attracted to these ideas.
Yeah.
Like Spider-Man is attracted to danger. It's like, I might as well be a superhero then. If it's going to come to me like this, I might as well develop something. So that's something that I've been doing. And the more and more I do, the more I'm like, I love this, you know. And it's just to hear about certain things, like Kathy Kennedy was George Lucas' assistant.
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams was like worked on a Steven Spielberg, movie when he was young. I'm like, come on, man, we need to implement some of those, you know, those connections.
Apprenticeship, mentorship.
Especially for the unity and the future of what we would like to release, and then obviously having ownership and control over that. So I'm very, very interested in that side of things.
Cool. I'm excited to see what comes out.
Seriously. Do you think that there's a growing acceptance of more of these sort of different storytellers and stories? Is it happening kind of more on the audience side or from the sort of gatekeeper side, or maybe both?
I think both.
Yeah.
Both. I think some of the misconception is when people say, I think in general, human beings do one thing where sometimes we don't know how to kind of take in the complications and the details of the world stories. So we like to categorize it.
Right.
This versus this. So we like to make it much more simple. And you can see that in the culture of people going, well, if Hollywood do this, when Hollywood make that, it's like, who's Hollywood?
Right.
Right.
Who are you talking about? Hollywood are a mixture of people from high class to working class or a whole bunch of creatives. And there are people that have those experiences, the same experiences I have, and who are in Hollywood, who are open to those stories. To find them and to filter, obviously, is another journey. But, you know, there's a mixture. So I feel like on industry side, obviously, if you connect with people who have that awareness, and by the way, some of these people are white.
Yeah, it's like, true.
I can't lie. It's just factual. I've met people and I've sat down and they go, look, well, I funded this movie. I actually put my money in this film, and this is what I want to make next. Are you game? These people are white people saying this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, for me, the complication and the confusion of that mixed with obviously the audience that it's happening on both sides, but it's all about what is done now and whether or not, you know, industry side that is going to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's coming up.
No, it's coming.
It's coming up for sure.
No, so I speak to a lot of actors. You know, I'm like, yo, you need to produce. Like, you need to get in and write something. And, you know, come into the office anytime and come visit us if you lot. Because I want more people to create. Then we won't have a lot of these discussions.
Right.
I'm not about to, you know, if I have children in this lifetime, I don't want to have to, you know, have to say, well, this is why they don't have a lot of, you know, black people on screen. I don't have to do that. I don't even want to have the conversation.
Right, yeah.
To be done. In order to do that, I think that much more people in front of the screen have to then find, you know, their way behind to help to aid them, which is good.
Exactly.
How exciting if that generation isn't shocked to see two people of color in a movie and be like, oh, they can have more than one.
Yeah, right. my nephews play with the Finn figures.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's cool to see that, you know. Yeah. But I also think it's even so dope and even more cool when you even see a white kid.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, cool. I see what this does. You know, it's a double-edged sword, but in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, on one side, a kid feels that he's represented and can love this character because the character looks like me, man.
Right.
You know, and he's got hair like me. On the other side, look, white kid can feel like I relate to this character who probably isn't like me physically, but I still relate to him anyway, which is something that we kind of can lose, you know, in the growth of that.
And that's what we need in real life.
Oh, yeah.
So that's where it's really significant.
Yeah.
So we wrap up our podcast with two questions for you that we ask everyone. The first is called Hollywood Remix, and it's what's a past example of a sci-fi film that you would love to revise or recast or see redone, maybe with a more diverse cast or an old school show or film you'd love to see them do a new take?
I would have thought about this deeply. like my mind is blank right now.
We'll ask you the second one, and that'll jog, because the second one is related, but it's called The Hidden Gem, which is there, again, a story? It could be a movie, TV show, or an anime or anything that highlights people of color in sci-fi that you would like to just recommend to your listeners, that, you know, this is a hidden gem that more people should know about.
I think the anime Afro Samurai.
Afro Samurai, yeah. Yeah.
Really, really good. And obviously voiced by Samuel Jackson. Really cool, a good vibe.
Yeah.
I think people should watch that. Because it's weird, it's a dystopian world, it's just a mixture of cultures all in one. I think that would be really, really cool to see. I just thought about it though. And Attack the Block maybe was supposed to be this. To see E.T. with a bunch of black kids would be funny.
And how their parents would react. Yes, it'd be a different family.
I wanna see that, you know. Hence why I'm doing preparing for a project now called They Clone Tyrone.
I heard about that.
Basically South. About a secret organization underneath the hood that are cloning black people. And I love, just reading the scripts, it makes me laugh because there's just cultural, like, stereotypical, in a sense, to a certain extent. But things that, you know, we just laugh at, it's just so funny. You'd be like, oh man, that's some black people shit. That's something that we would do, man. That's funny. And I love seeing that implemented in something like a classic like E.T., you know, one of those childhood stories where it's just young kids, but they're just really just talking shit, just talking how they want to. One of them has braids, another one has puffy hair, and there's a Latino guy in there, you know, there's a guy from China that's just come to the country, you know. That would be hilarious.
Really. That would be... I feel like that's where these nostalgic shows are going. I was just thinking about like Lucas from Stranger Things, and this is like a black kid in the 80s growing up in Indiana who just loves Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah,
and
I love that.
He has always existed, and now we see it on screen. Yeah, it's great.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate
really appreciate it. And for anyone who may not be paying attention, Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker is out December 20th.
I'm sure you already have your tickets, because if you don't, it's too late.
Big thank you to all the fans for supporting me, especially me and Daisy over the years. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, most of the Star Wars fans are just phenomenal, and they've been... You know, through all the ups and through all the downs, they've just been consistent in their support. And I'd like to say a big special thank you to you lot. Like, you lot are dope. So.
It's awesome. Well, once you're part of the family, you're part of the family. Thank you, John.
We just want to say a quick thanks again to John Boyega for joining us to talk all things Star Wars. In case you've been living under a rock, The Rise of Skywalker is out December 20th.
And be sure to tune in next Wednesday for our season one finale of Hollywood Remixed, when we sit down with Brooklyn Nine-Nine star Stephanie Beatriz and talk about Latinas, specifically LGBTQ Latinas on television. That episode comes out Christmas Day.
And be sure to check out our past episodes and subscribe to Hollywood Remixed on your favorite podcasting platform.
Until then, live long and prosper. Just kidding! I know that's from Star Trek. May the Force be with you.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.